Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Arts and Humanities Council of Tulsa recently celebrated its 50th anniversary. Today we look at the future of the council, the future of arts funding in general, and how the council's new 42,000 square foot Hardesty Art Center, which will add classroom, gallery, and studio space for local visual artists in the rapidly developing Brady District, will affect the arts here in our community when it opens later this fall. In addition, the council kicks off its annual Oklahoma Chautauqua event tonight at OSU Tulsa, this year celebrating Hollywood's impact on American culture. Behind the Screen gets underway tonight at 7:30 with a presentation by scholar Doug Mishler portraying the film mogul Jack Warner. Join us today to talk about all of that is the Arts and Humanities Council CEO, Ken Busby. Ken Busby is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Ken Busby, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Rich. It's good to be here.
Big times for the Arts and Humanities Council. You just celebrated your 50th anniversary. You have a major new facility that's about to come online this fall.
Yes, sir.
This would probably be a time when you have this big round anniversary of 50 years that you sort of start thinking about the next chapter of the council. What do you envision that being?
The next 50 years? Let's see. Or do you want a little closer than that?
Maybe a little closer.
Yeah. No, it's an exciting time for the council. And I think the new Hardesty Arts Center and AHA, as we affectionately call it, is really taking our programs to the next level. So all of the great things that we've been doing for the last 50 years, all of the arts education, all of the community outreach, all of the opportunities that we provided for a lot of at-risk and underserved communities now gets just stepped up a notch. And so the new AHA, as I like to say, is a place where you can get messy. Her Weldon, our fabulous home, and will always be our home, but that's a place for parties and receptions and weddings besides being our offices. And you can't get messy there. So this new Hardesty Art Center is going to allow us to have 2D, 3D, 4D classrooms, gallery space, studio space, and really provide a great home for the visual arts in the community that is going to allow us not only to take our programs to the next level, but just be an even greater resource to the community. And so we're just really excited about the opportunity.
So how do you complement this idea of a fixed structure with a lot of the outreach of the council, which I assume is in schools? It's the Har Weldon Institute where you're training teachers, and you're training the teachers to put together some sort of classroom project which involves arts coming into the schools.
Correct. So all of that continues.
Yeah.
Everything we've been doing continues. But now we have a home where we can do more after school, more weekend family programming, and really just provide more opportunities for youth and for adults to really experience the arts. So everything we've done with the Hardesty Arts Center is designed to just simply give more opportunity for creativity, more opportunity for the community to be involved and for people to engage the arts.
Now, when I hear that, I think of like studio art classes, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And certainly Philbrook has done that on and off over the years. Other museums and Waterworks continues to do that, really mainly for adults as well as kids. But
right.
So how does this fit in with existing niches?
Sure. Well, the cool thing is that we're able to partner just as we've done with so many institutions over the years. And all of that continues now, so that, the Gilcrease TU partnership that's created the new Zero Center for Art and Education, but it's really focused primarily on the great art programs for the students here at the University of Tulsa and the faculty and so forth. And their space is absolutely fabulous, and they're going to have wonderful gallery space. But we've already been talking with them about how, because none of us has just tremendously huge gallery space. We have a lot of gallery space, but we've talked about opportunities that we'll be able to partner between our institutions and have exhibits that may be in two or three parts, but yet they're all within the complex of the new Matthews Warehouse and the Hardesty Arts Center. And so we've talked about that as an opportunity. We are looking at joint programming so that when we bring in an artist in residence to do some really cool project with us, there might be a match to do something with Philbrook or a match to do something with Gilcrease or just a match with another community partner within Tulsa. So all of it's, we're having all of these discussions, and I know everyone loves meetings. No one probably more than I do, but the meetings that we're having are with community partners, universities, arts organizations, and so forth, to look at how we can foster more creativity, more art happenings, more opportunities for the entire community, and do this in a collaborative process so that we're not competing against each other. We're simply collaborating and lifting each other up.
Now, is this long overdue, this sort of idea of a visual arts center? You know, you have both museums
Sure.
Having space, the Brady Craft part of the building. But is this sort of long overdue? I mean, we've spent a lot of time on the performing arts and dramatic arts and things like that.
Sure.
But we really haven't tried to foster a visual arts community within the city. I mean, we have the great institutions that have great art, but as far as building up our local.
And how do you lift up the emerging artists? How do you lift up the younger people that really want to get into it? And that's exactly what we've said, and we as and our board of directors have said at the Arts and Humanities Council, is we've spent, as you just clearly illustrated, a lot of time on the performing arts and that kind of thing. But we haven't had a home, a real center, a real focus on the visual arts, except for things like Gilcrease and Philbrook and the Sherwin Miller and so forth. And so this is our opportunity, certainly within proximity of the Performing Arts Center and how much it has added to our community, to now do the same thing for the visual arts. And so with what we're doing with Gilcrease and Philbrook, the new Brady Craft Alliance, the Woody Guthrie Museum coming online, all of that is just a real great opportunity to foster the local artist, the young creatives, the old creatives, people that just have an interest in the visual arts. And we think this is going to be able to create a great nexus with this compound, if you will, this city block of arts programming that's really going to allow us to do that.
Yeah. What about the other missions of the Arts and Humanities Council? Anything going to change? I mean, you know, for arts organizations, I think we've been hearing it for about the last decade that things are going to get tighter. And now you're starting to see lots of articles talking about the fact that if you're depending on government funding, watch out, because it doesn't matter who's in charge. This is either going to be tightened or eliminated altogether. Does that put a new role on groups like you, which is sort of like an umbrella for a lot of smaller groups sort of like the conduit for everybody in many ways when it works right?
Absolutely, and that's what we try to be, and that focus doesn't change. I think, to your point, one never counts on federal dollars. One never counts on government dollars for those very reasons. That's always first looked at to be slashed. We are really focused and helping not only ourselves but other organizations, arts organizations, focus on relevance. What are you doing? What are you providing to the community that they wouldn't get anywhere else? And why is that critically important to the not only quality of life, but to education, to all of those values that we as a community say we hold dear? So as we're doing, just as we recommend to other organizations, it's spreading the net. It's making yourself aware. It's making other people aware of what you're doing and what your mission is and what that means to the lives of your children, your grandchildren, the community at large, and all of those things. And while that sounds rather grandiose, it's absolutely essential because, and I get back to the word relevance, we have to demonstrate why what we do matters, why it's just as important as any other agency in terms of. Of course, social service agencies are critically important, but there's an arts component, too, that can go in with that that makes it all worthwhile. Education, sure, math, science, critically important, but there's an arts component that, when added to that, allows students to do better in math and science. So it's for the arts groups, I think it's just an awareness factor, and that we have to just keep reminding people the good things that we are doing and that we are complementing everything else that needs to be happening in a community.
How good are our arts groups in general at communicating that need of relevance, given the fact that, you know, social service budgets are equal, you know, more
strapped too.
They're strained as arts budgets. Education, you know, we're looking at flat funding going into this next year.
Absolutely.
Again, and
major
cuts.
About that.
No. And so how do you make that? How do you make that argument when, you know, we're not even funding these sorts of things, which we think are extremely relevant?
Sure. That's a tough one, Rich. I mean, there's no easy way around it. One of the things I think that we do is, we've been fortunate enough this year to form a new partnership with the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts and our Any Given Child initiative. Tulsa was the fifth city in the country to be selected for this program. We're partnering with Tulsa Public Schools to provide a quality arts experiences that are age appropriate for kindergarten through eighth grade for every Tulsa Public School student. We spent the last year evaluating, seeing what we need to do. We're putting our plans together to go forward, and we'll begin implementing that in the 2012-2013 year. You just mentioned we have flat funding from the state going into the school, so how are we going to manage this?
Can the private dollars pick up the slack, or is this something you were really counting on state funding for, or educational funding?
Golly, no. We weren't counting on state funding for that. Two things have happened that have been great. we've had Dr. Keith Ballard, who has a commitment to the arts and has worked very hard to try to maintain a level of arts instruction in the schools. That was a requirement of the Kennedy Center. We had to have a superintendent that was on board. We had to have a mayor that was on board. And we had to have the philanthropic community on board. And the Charles and Lynn Schusterman Family Foundation stepped up on the philanthropic side, says, yes, we're going to help you make this happen. They can't do it all by themselves, but they're helping in a huge way to get us started and get us launched. And so with all those partners in place, the Kennedy Center has looked at the resources and so forth. And so what we're trying to figure out now is strategically how to direct all of the arts organizations to work with age-appropriate levels of children so that we can provide those quality experiences without perhaps having to add too many new dollars. In other words, we're going to focus our efforts. So whether we're working with the Tulsa Ballet or Tulsa Symphony, Tulsa Opera, theater groups, Philbrook Gilchrist, we will focus, Arts Humanities Council of Tulsa, will focus our efforts on specific grades, specific areas, and so forth, where we can best serve and meet those needs. And maybe we don't do as much with other ages and so forth, but we are focused here because our quality experience is going to be in this area. And the ballet could focus here at this age-appropriate level, and the symphony can do this. And so we're realigning ourselves and strategically looking at how we can provide the best quality for the students.
And all those organizations are doing that, but right. There's never been any sort of umbrella to sort of set parameters where this is your year. You know, the
right.
Seventh graders are your year, and
now go.
you give them the dance component,
right,
or
right.
Sixth graders for symphony, or
right.
whatever.
And
yeah.
So, I mean, this has been talked about before, and if I start naming names, I'll leave somebody out. But I know Linda Frazier, for example, really championed this whole idea of working with arts for all. And it was this integrated idea, and it's been talked about for probably 10, 15 years, and it was a great idea, but it just never really got off the ground in a big way, mainly because of funding. It's just one of those things. But with that initiative going in the background, as we got into this Any Given Child initiative and realized how much of what the Kennedy Center was doing aligned with the things that we had valued as a community, we realized that this was our opportunity through Any Given Child to really make that idea a reality. So I think we're finally getting to where we can actually put something in place that is going to do that, and we're going to help coordinate that, we, the Arts and Humanities Council, for everyone.
I know one of the big things when you do any sort of funding initiative is accountability, and it sounds like this is set up for, you know, to see some real efficacy at the end of the year, where you can say, if one organization basically has a responsibility for a grade, you know, and mm-hmm. you teach, say, orchestral music or you know, classical music uh-huh. through the year, there's a great way to measure that, as opposed to this sort of hit and miss, and maybe one year we get all the sixth graders, maybe not, we can't do it for another year or two, and we get the fourth graders some year, or whoever basically decides to devote class time to an art unit.
Oh, absolutely. And so we're actually working with OU Tulsa, the Schusterman campus, to we have a researcher on staff, well, on their staff, who's providing assistance to us so that we can be very accountable, do research, do quantitative measurement and qualitative as well, but to really be able to demonstrate that we have moved these children from point A to point B over the course of a year, that we've really had this kind of positive impact, and that we can actually measure it and demonstrate it and give that back not only to the funding community, but to the government and so forth. So I say it is making a difference. The arts do matter, and here's why and here's how, and it's concrete. You can't dispute these numbers.
So the first point you need to make as an arts organization is relevance.
Absolutely.
And then second, if you're doing outreach, is it effective?
Is it effective? And everybody wants to know that. And rightly so. Gone are the days of wonderful, benevolent philanthropists who just gave to give. They're still out there, and they're still giving. And we have, as you know, in this community, we have a major, wonderful donor community. But they still want to see that there's value in what they're doing, that because every dollar is counting so much more, because social services and everybody has such a greater need and government resources are declining, the philanthropic community has to determine how best to support those initiatives that are going to help the community as a whole move people forward, move the continuum, continue things in a positive direction. And so it is only right that the arts community be relevant and be accountable and explain, and this is what we're doing, and this is the positive impact we're making, and here it is so that you can see for yourself. No smoke and mirrors, just as the reality.
You may not want to get into this, but you know, the other part of it is the philanthropic community is aging, and you're starting to see a generation that's moving into philanthropy that hasn't had the extensive music education and arts education that an earlier generation did.
That's true.
And that was part of the popular culture. Like, you know, the generation that grew up with Leonard Bernstein giving the Sunday afternoon concert for young people, mm-hmm. or hearing it on the radio or television arts programming, which was ubiquitous in the 50s and early 60s.
Absolutely.
Not so much in the intervening decades. And
Absolutely.
So you might have a philanthropic community that increasingly doesn't have that passion and love.
Absolutely. And simply is not aware, through no fault of its own, just isn't aware because they weren't experiencing it. So again, back to the education side, this is where arts organizations, working with educators and so forth, have to just continue to send the message out there and make the message clear. This is the value that we have. This is what your parents and grandparents supported. Here's what we're doing today, and now we're even better at what we do. We're even more accountable in what we do. We have even better statistics to show you what we're doing. But this is why we're relevant, and this is why it matters, and this is why we need you to continue that support.
All right. My guest today is Ken Busby, the CEO of the Arts and Humanities Council of Tulsa. The Arts and Humanities Council recently celebrated its 50th anniversary. As you go downtown in the Brady District, you keep seeing more steel going up on their site for the artist, the Arts Center, which is scheduled to open when?
We're going to open in December. At the moment, 14, 15, 16. Those look like pretty solid dates. Our construction's on time. And we're actually on budget, which is just making me really happy.
Have you topped out yet?
We will be topping out. You heard it here first, folks. It looks like June 20th of this year,
okay.
So very soon.
Uh-huh.
Looks like that's about the right date for topping out, so we're very excited about that. But everything is just going extremely well.
That's right. It's a much bigger building than I thought.
42,000 square feet. And I've got to say, Seltzer Schaefer Architects have just done a phenomenal job for us. It's a beautiful building. Flint Co. Constructive Services is doing the construction, and it's going to be an amazing feat. For the Arts and Humanities Council, this is a huge step for us in terms of our programming, additional community outreach, and I think mainly because this is not something we do. We don't do capital campaigns every few years. This is the second one in our entire 50-year history, and we don't plan to really do more. We'll continue focusing on programming as we go forward, of course, but it's like we've set up another building to get this for the next 50 years, so we're cool now.
Yeah, well, and it sounds like a great center for education and the like, but more importantly, you know, for downtown, it's like you have these three or four facilities that are coming online. It's a great way to just spend a lunch hour, you know, because,
Absolutely.
And I assume this building is really open to the public.
Absolutely, which is way cool.
You know what I mean? So you can watch kids learning to paint or you know, doing something like that?
Absolutely. No, we'll be open every day, and I couldn't tell you now what the hours all will be, but yes, we'll be open and so forth. But you mentioned the lunch hour. One of the things that we have are what we're calling community studios, and they're on our first floor on the sidewalk as you're walking down Archer, as you're coming toward our street between Cincinnati and Boston, and on good weather days like we have in Oklahoma every once in a while, the glass doors can actually be opened very easily, and people can just walk in and have an arts experience. So we're going to actually have things set up at lunchtime. So people just in the neighborhood, walking over the Boston Bridge from downtown, whatever, can come in and have those experiences. And one of the people I like to credit for some of this idea is Tom Wallace at Wallace Engineering. When he moved his firm downtown, one of the reasons he told me, so I'm quoting him, that he moved downtown was because we were planning to build a new visual arts center, and he wanted his staff on lunch hours to have places to go to have really cool experiences and do more creative things like they do in the engineering world. And so we see this. We have people talking to us all the time about they can't wait to come over, they can't wait to participate. So we're really engaged in that thinking that we've got to have all kinds of hands-on participatory stuff for all ages so you can just drop in and have an experience and do something cool and then move on, but in a short amount of time. So if you only got 20, 30, 40 minutes, we can do that.
When I think of this, our area, though, with also the Philbrook, the University of Tulsa, the Gilcrease, mm-hmm. and the Brady Craft Alliance buildings there all together, and just across the street, you're going to have a wonderful park.
I know. The park's going to be awesome.
You know, this is going to be a hub, I think, for downtown.
A huge hub. So we currently have a First Friday art crawl, the first Friday of each month and so forth. And I just think now what it's doing and what it'll be a year from now as all of this gets online and everything gets up and going. Truly, from a marketing standpoint for downtown, not only within the local community, but for the Tulsa Metro Chamber to promote about why to come to Tulsa, why to come visit Tulsa, this arts district is going to be an amazing center for that kind of activity and creativity. And I think it's really going to be an aspect that will set Tulsa apart and make people, I got to go visit Tulsa. If you've never been to Tulsa, hey, guess what they've got going? And I think that word of mouth is really going to drive it.
My guest is Ken Busby, CEO of the Arts and Humanities Council of Tulsa. In addition to celebrating their 50th anniversary, one of their long-running programs opens today, and that is Chautauqua. How long has Arts and Humanities Council been doing Chautauqua?
I believe this is our 21st year. This is our 21st year, yeah.
And this was based on the old idea of the Chautauqua Tent traveling lecture series, if you will. It would be a little bit of music. It would be lecturers on various issues of the day, just like they do at the Chautauqua Institution each summer in upstate New York.
Absolutely.
But this was a traveling version, and you've recreated it with these scholars who sort of adopt the persona of historic people.
Right.
And you do this theme each year, and this year it's a little bit off the beaten path for Chautauqua, I think, but it's about this... It's about the great era of the silver screen.
Of Hollywood, right, yeah. Right. And it is. We do, as you mentioned, we do a different theme each year. And we do characters, obviously, that are no longer living. So we always go back into history, even if it's recent history, a little bit to be able to do that. But it's a fun program. This is the longest-running Chautauqua, continuous-running Chautauqua in the country now, and one of the very largest humanities programs in the state of Oklahoma. So we're really excited about that. And, of course, we travel to a couple of other cities as well. Just like the Chautauqua Tent revivals did and so forth. We still do ours under a tent on the campus of OSU Tulsa, which is great. And this year's characters, some are going to be very familiar to people. I think some may not be as familiar to people.
And some will be familiar to you, but not really in the role that you're seeing them in conjunction with Hollywood. I'm thinking of William
Faulkner.
You're
thinking of William Faulkner.
Absolutely. Yeah, who wrote screenplays for
Absolutely. A while. That's our reason for including him. He had had some very close relationships with Jack Warner, the producer and director, and wrote screenplays. Faulkner, one of my favorite authors, but in a wholly new context now. So you can come and experience them each evening and see them in a whole new way. Of course, Bob Hope is a legendary screen actor and so forth. So that should be an interesting addition. A lot of people know Gordon Parks. Gordon Parks, a great photographer, also directed one of the first African-Americans to direct a major Hollywood motion picture. So, again, these characters are just fascinating people. And so each night in first-person persona, you get to learn about them through a monologue, if you will. And then the audience gets to ask questions of them in that role and then ask questions of the scholars who perform them. So it's a great learning opportunity.
And that's going on each evening, but during the day you have some seminars.
We have workshops each day.
And so you might have the scholar really talking about the process of learning about this character or some aspect of their life outside of the main presentation.
Absolutely. So you get into the nitty-gritty, if you will, or what made them tick or issues that they had or things that they were dealing with at the time. So it's really some in-depth learning, and that takes place each day, beginning today and then through Saturday.
Yeah. And for people who want more information about Chautauqua, what's the best way to get it? Is it online at this
point? It is online, yes. Yeah. And we have a direct website for it, which is okchautauqua.org. I should probably spell that. okchautauqua.org.
Just remember there are three U's.
There are three U's. It's like, I always joke with people, it's Chautauqua, just like you would spell it. It sounds just like you'd spell it. Not really, but it's funny to say that anyway.
Just how you'd spell it with a U at the end of each.
With a U.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, we hope a lot of people come out to Chautauqua, and I know everybody's looking forward to the opening of the Hardesty building this fall.
Not long.
And Ken, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich. Really enjoyed it.
Ken Busby is the CEO of the Arts and Humanities Council of Tulsa. The Arts and Humanities Council, in conjunction with the Oklahoma Humanities Council, presents Oklahoma Chautauqua tonight through Saturday at the Big Tent at OSU Tulsa. It gets underway tonight at 7:30 with scholar Doug Mishler portraying film mogul Jack Warner. Other scholars later in the week will portray Ethel Waters, Bob Hope, William Faulkner, and Gordon Parks. This year's theme is Behind the Screen, Hollywood's Impact on Oklahoma Culture. You can learn more, again, at the website okchautauqua.org. Thank you. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Colin Hines.
Nothing brings out the pitchforks and torches like suggesting that citizens be subjected to a change in the way their trash is collected by the city. Most Tulsans are accustomed to lugging their own round trash cans to the curb twice a week. Soon enough, the city of Tulsa will provide its citizens with large uniform carts with wheels. Residents will have their trash picked up once a week or can pay more for having the privilege to do twice as much work and wheel their carts to the curb twice a week. Carts will also be provided for material suitable for recycling. This monumental change has some very upset. Change can be harrowing, I know. I grew up only knowing the old twice-a-week service, but one day, suddenly, and without warning, my world would never be the same again. This is when my wife and I moved to an historic neighborhood on the northwest side of downtown in 1999. As we were moving our furniture in, I saw it, up the driveway and against the side of the house, sitting there, menacingly. It was a cart, green, and about 4 feet tall and 3 feet wide, with a big black lid and blacker wheels. "What's that?" I asked the neighbor, pointing to the cart. "That's a trash cart," said the neighbor. Without sugarcoating it, he explained that we should put our trash in it and roll it to the curb, on Tuesdays, as in once per week. Monday evening came. Standing in the driveway, I stared at the cart for a long time. The cart didn't flinch. My knees went weak, and I retreated. Tuesday morning arrived, and I had no choice but to summon the courage and do what had to be done. In my robe and slippers, I approached the cart slowly, trying not to look at it directly. A mere 2 feet from it, I reached out to grab the suspiciously convenient handle that was integrated within the lid. I suffered a temporary case of the staggering vapors. With the back of my hand pressed to my forehead, I stumbled a few steps backwards. Then, with newfound resolve, I grabbed the handle of the cart and rolled it to the curb, but forgot to breathe and almost passed out on the way there. I jumped back with a heaving chest. The cart did nothing but sit there smugly on the curb, waiting for the trash haulers to arrive and empty its contents. 13 years later, and after having rolled out my cart, who I eventually named Theodore, approximately 676 times and counting, I can testify that, in fact, against all odds, I like it, and I would never want to go back to heaving and dragging round cans to the curb twice a week. If I can adapt, anyone can.
Colin Hines is a local attorney, a writer, and the author of the blog Colin Hines Moleskin. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own, do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The nonprofit Tulsa Roots Music presents Texas music supergroup The Flatlanders in Tulsa Sunday night, June 10th at 7 p.m. at the historic Tulsa Little Theater near 15th and Delaware. The Flatlanders, comprised of Jimmy Dale Gilmore, Butch Hancock, and Joe Ely, are now on their 40th anniversary tour. You can learn more about this show, for which Jason Eady will be the opening act, at tulsarootsmusic.org.